Elan Vital is the hypothetical life force that was postulated to explain the differences between living and non-living systems. Self-organization, regeneration, metabolism, replication, evolution. Prior to modern biology, these phenomena were utterly mysterious. Immanuel Kant famously said, "There will never be an Isaac Newton for a blade of grass." In 1907, Henry Bergson coined the term élan vital in his book Creative Evolution to explain the perplexing capacities of living matter. You could almost think of this as the hard problem of life. How do you make this jump from non-living systems to living systems? It was commonly held that life could never be explained in materialistic, mechanistic terms. Living systems have all these interesting, unique properties. For instance, they can reproduce, they can repair themselves, they can metabolize. It was widely believed that there would never be a mechanistic explanation for these phenomena. That's why we needed élan vital, a non-physical, animating force that could make sense of the fact that life is so different from non-life. Once we learned more about the mechanisms of life, however, there was just nothing left for élan vital to explain. We could rule it out on grounds of simplicity alone. It wasn't necessary to explain anything. Besides, how good of an explanation was a life force to begin with? The biologist and panpsychist, Julian Huxley, once remarked that élan vital is no better an explanation of life than explaining the operation of a train by its élan locomotif. It would seem that just about every opponent of panpsychism has made this appeal to élan vital at least once. Consciousness might seem like a mystery now, but you just wait. Once we do just a bit more neuroscience, it'll be clear how we can get the subjective from the objective. Of course, there are plenty of cases in which we get A from not A, fluidity being the most common example. The Jerry Coynes and Massimo Pialuccis of the world are confident that panpsychists are making the same mistake Kant made when he asserted that there would never be an Isaac Newton for a blade of grass. Once we learn more about the so-called easy problems of consciousness, they argue, the hard problem will simply evaporate, just like the need for a life force gradually evaporated. When I was a materialist a couple years ago, I made the same comparison. Elan vital is actually a terrible analogy for consciousness, or panpsychism, and the comparison is made all the time. Unless you're an illusionist about consciousness, you shouldn't be drawing this analogy. Elan vital is an illusion. Experience is not. Unless you believe consciousness is illusory, it's a strange comparison to draw. There are crucial differences between the two. Elan vital was postulated to explain observations. We took confusing data and attributed those data to a mysterious force. Consciousness, on the other hand, is not being postulated to explain data. We already know that consciousness exists. It's a datum that needs explaining. So consciousness isn't like élan vital. It's more like self-organization, regeneration, metabolism, replication, and evolution. The things that needed to be explained. We're not postulating experience as a mysterious substance or force to explain confusing observations. Consciousness can't fall out of favor as an explanation because it's not an explanation. It's the thing that needs to be explained. That's where the true disanalogy lies. If you do subscribe to illusionism, then I would argue that you're perfectly within your rights to use the élan vital comparison. On your view, consciousness isn't real. I'm not sure what this illusion is appearing in if consciousness isn't real. The appearance of an illusion is an actual instance of the thing you say doesn't exist, but I guess that's a topic for another day. At any rate, neither élan vital nor consciousness exist to an illusionist, but most people are not illusionists. So unless you're in the tiny minority of philosophers who think the one thing that can't be an illusion is an illusion, please stop using the élan vital analogy. The vitalism analogy is lazy. It doesn't make any sense as a comparison. We'll never understand neuroscience so well that we stop believing in conscious experience. It was possible, even in the heyday of vitalism, to see that panpsychism and vitalism were not analogous hypotheses. Julian Huxley, quoted earlier, was a panpsychist, and a critic of Alain Vittel. In fact, he came up with the Alain locomotive criticism that's so popular among reductionists. Quote, "Mind, or something of the nature as mind, must exist throughout the entire universe. This, I believe, the truth." End quote. So take fluidity. This is a much better version of the point materialists are trying to make with a life force, but there's still a disanalogy, this time with the reductive story that's being told. There's a reductive story you can tell about a whirlpool, for instance, that makes sense even if you know nothing about fluid mechanics. Even though I couldn't solve equations in fluid mechanics, I can still get the gist of what's happening when you tell me the reductive story. But the hand-waving reductive accounts of experience can't even do that. They just appeal to other stories that actually make sense. Whenever you ask for an account of how a brain generates experience, how you go from the objective to the subjective, they just appeal to a different story that actually does make sense and assert that consciousness is just like that. But you don't have to appeal to some other case to explain fluidity. You can just explain fluidity. On the other hand, if I ask how a third-person description of physical behavior is supposed to ever lead to an account of subjective experience, materialists appeal to some other reductive story that does make sense and baselessly assert that consciousness is just like that. Thomas Nagel wrote, nearly half a century ago in his famous essay, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? Quote, "The recent wave of reductionist euphoria has produced several analyses of mental phenomena and mental concepts designed to explain the possibility of some variety of materialism. But the problems dealt with are those common to this type of reduction and other types, and what makes the mind-body problem unique, and unlike the water H2O problem, or the Turing machine IBM machine problem, or the lightning electrical discharge problem, or the gene DNA problem, or the oak tree hydrocarbon problem, is ignored. Every reductionist has his favorite analogy from modern science. It is most unlikely that any of these unrelated examples of successful reduction will shed light on the relation of mind to brain. But philosophers share the general human weakness for explanations of what is incomprehensible in terms suited for what is familiar and well understood, though entirely different. This has led to the acceptance of implausible accounts of the mental, largely because they would permit familiar kinds of reduction. Without consciousness, the mind-body problem would be much less interesting. With consciousness, it seems hopeless. The most important and characteristic feature of conscious mental phenomena is very poorly understood. Most reductionist theories do not even try to explain it." End quote. The experiential, essentially qualitative, what it is like of consciousness has not been explained by neuroscience and never will be. It's a category mistake to think that it can. Nearly a century ago, Russell and Eddington realized that physics tells us what matter does and how it behaves. It doesn't tell us about the intrinsic nature of matter, insofar as there is more to matter than its structure. Physics doesn't actually suggest that fundamental reality is wholly non-experiential. This is what Galen Strawson calls the silence of physics. A physical science like neuroscience can obviously tell us true things about physical stuff, which is all I believe is up here in my skull. Neuroscience can teach us about brain structure, how it will behave under certain conditions, and so on, but neuroscience can only provide correlations. It can't tell us about the intrinsic nature of matter. You have to report your experiences with behavior like speech, because the internal aspect to the matter of which you're made is not empirically observable. You can't observe consciousness, except in your own case. No one else can directly perceive your experience, and you can't directly perceive anyone else's, no matter what technology comes along. Even if we could measure all your brain activity and put what was going on a screen with perfect representation, that still wouldn't change that consciousness, the internal aspect, is unobservable. What that hypothetical machine would be doing is measuring external behavior and structure and relation and translating it. You have to actually be the chunk of matter to directly observe the experience. Science is unable in principle to explain Nagelian consciousness. The reason why is discussed at length in Nagel's book, Mind and Cosmos, and Philip Goff's recent book, Galileo's Error. consciousness was put in brackets at the beginning of the scientific revolution. It won't explain experience because it can't. It was never intended to. We've completely forgotten the philosophical underpinnings of science. Physical science may be silent on what or if it's like something for a bit of matter like myself. But what reason do we have to suppose that there is more than structure and behavior when it comes to matter? First, there is not as much evidence as one would think that non-conscious matter exists. We actually don't know there is any non-experiential stuff, and the reasons for supposing there even is such a thing are terrible. The biggest clue we have of the intrinsic nature of matter is the fact that we are a part of the physical universe. We are made of matter. Putting yourself outside the universe, looking in as if you're an impartial observer, is a bad habit, and it's one that religion bears some responsibility for keeping around for so long. If you believe we're made of matter alone, then the one thing we know for certain about matter is that it's at least sometimes conscious. It has that internal aspect that panpsychists are proposing, at least some of the time, perhaps all the time. Brains, for example, have an internal aspect, unobservable from the outside. You're not made of stuff that's different from all the other stuff. Postulating non-experiential matter at the fundamental levels is theoretically more expensive and totally unjustified. If you want to postulate non-experiential stuff as the fundamental stuff, since your intuitive theory of mind is infallible, then the burden is on you to explain why you think there is such a thing as matter for which it's not like anything to be. Matter that lacks the internal aspect that you have. To quote Galen Strawson, there is zero evidence for the existence of non-experiential reality anywhere in the universe. So why simply assume that the fundamental things are non-experiential and then cause this huge problem for yourself? End quote. We know there is experiential matter, and we do not know if there's any non-experiential matter. If we suppose there is such a thing, we'll either have to subscribe to radical emergence or illusionism. I'm not comfortable with either of those options. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll talk to you next time.